Last week. This week we're going to be talking about the Mongol invasion of China's Middle Kingdom and its very limited impact on postmodern Calvinism. Or we could go by the differences between the Eastern and the Western Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, and we'll stick with that this evening. First of all, Europe. By the time we get into the 6th century, the Roman Empire looks a whole lot different than it did earlier. In fact, the Roman Empire doesn't even exist as we would normally think about it, because Rome is in the hands of Germanic tribes of Goths, as well as most of Europe. And lots of little tiny kingdoms that are pagan, but Rome itself is not in charge of Rome. And the eastern end of the Roman Empire is a giant city, Byzantium, later to be known as Constantinople. About 527, along comes an emperor, Justinian. And Justinian the Great has a lot of different names, but Justinian started looking at the empire and was really upset that they had lost the western end of it. In fact, its home. And decided he would go take it back. And in his life, he made huge strides towards that. In fact, he actually did take Rome back several times. And it wasn't always a successful hold, but he did go to Rome several times and conquered it. Belisarius was his great general that he sent on all the campaigns, because Justinian didn't do much fighting himself, if any. And but he had two great generals that did all of that. Belisarius was his primary hammer. That was the guy that he used to do things. And he managed to get back portions of Italy, portions of Spain and southern Europe, as well as all of North Africa that had been conquered prior to that, different nations holding each one. Eventually all of that would be lost to the Moors, so all of his gains would be lost. But his real target was reuniting the Roman Empire under Byzantium, so the rule was coming from the east, and then trying to unite all of the Mediterranean under Christ. The Byzantium Empire, the Byzantine Empire, was a little bit different than the Roman Empire had been, because a lot of what Constantine had done, where he became kind of king and religious ruler, Byzantium really stretched that, so that under Justinian was the head of the church and the head of the empire. Not everybody liked him because of that, and a lot of the things that he did fell back, but that's that. Caesaropapism, that concept of church and government being the same thing, was something that really appears at this time. There's a close connection between what goes on in the physical world and what goes on in the spiritual world in Eastern religion. And so because of that, it was a natural thing for them to assume that their emperor was also the leader of the church. That didn't go as well in the West, because we don't view it that way. The Europeans didn't view it that way even then. During his reign, huge archaeological events occurred. They built the Hagia Sophia Church. Even today it still exists, even though it's been off and on a Muslim shrine. It has been taken and retaken. Patriarchs were the way the church was ruled. It wasn't ruled by a papacy or a single pope that still existed in Rome. And not as potent as the pope that we now know, that came later. But instead of having a single ruler out of a single city, every major city had a bishop or an elder. That was kind of the head bishop or elder of that region. And anything that they decided in the whole church, those men came together and then decided them more in committee than they did with one person issuing a bull that said, this is now law. And that's the way that it ran. But as time progressed, they stopped referring to the scriptures so much and started referring to the fathers. Because just like we see in Roman Catholicism, a lot of what had been decided before became law. And that's what they ran with. Controversies. There were some theological controversies that came up, and one of them was the doctrine of God, or what is the nature of Jesus? And that's something that we've talked about already, is people had this real concern, could Jesus sin? Was he a man, or was he God, or was he both? And people were willing to fight about that. they weren't very happy with the other people's interpretation, because you have an Eastern concept of spirituality that is somewhat different than the Western concept of spirituality, and they really had a hard time reconciling that. So in the in one of the big events where they all got together, they had the Council of Chalcedon, or Chalcedon, and they decided there that he actually had two wills. And that was a major decision. The Council of Constantinople, the third council in 680, concluded that Christ also had two natures. So he had the human will, which desired to do ill, like a broken man, and he had the logos, or the godly will, and it always overrode. And he also had the broken nature of man, the nature of a human, and he had the nature of God, the logos of God, and it always overrode in his case. And that allowed them to explain a lot of things, some of these intricate discussions and arguments that we had talked about earlier that came up, things that don't make as much sense to us today. They don't apply as directly to us, but they were taking them within their culture and trying to figure out, well, this is very important to us because we're coming from a Greek understanding of the world. Why can't we say various things? And when you go in and you bring the gospel to Greek people, they're coming from the standpoint of all of these gods that behave like humans, and they want to apply human attributes to them. So those doctrines become important, whereas today we look at it and think, why did they even argue about those? But in every culture, as culture develops, within that culture there become issues with Christ. And every new generation then has to look at what the Bible says and determine what they're going to believe. It's not something that can be decided once for all. You still have to go to the Scriptures. The problem that they decided said, okay, well, we're going to say that Christ has two wills and two natures. And the shift was to preserve unity, but keep distinction within the person of Christ. You had to get East and West to agree so that there was one church. But you had to be able to fit both philosophies about human nature. And that was the really difficult part that they had. And so they started having these councils to talk about it. The one that we talked about, the Constantinople Council, the third, that council said, okay, well, we're going to say he has two wills and two natures. But later, they had other councils, and there's this shift back and forth. So in Ephesus, you get this Alexandrian idea. And in Chalcedon, you have Antioch. In Constantinople, you have Alexandrian. And then finally, the last one, you get the Antioch again. And that Antioch idea is two wills, two natures. And that's kind of what they stick with for a while. Although, when a different emperor would come in, sometimes a different rule would come in. And we're going to find that later as we also talk about saints and relics, how that came into play from their view of mysticism. Talking about the difference in rituals and mysticism within worship, they were a lot different in East from West. And there were a lot of impacts over time that changed them. Ritual practices were really important to the Eastern Church. That's where you see everything has an exact right way of doing it, and it must be done this way every single time, or it simply doesn't count. Symbols, incense, different types of musical forms. There were specific musical forms for each part of worship, and you had to do those exact things, or it didn't count. It was not right. And then finally, they had their liturgy. The things that they taught were always the same. It was rich. It wasn't like it was just a couple of things. They had a lot of things that they were teaching, but it was very concise. It had to agree with the whole church. This brought up an issue that becomes part of this discussion of differences between the East and the West, and then what we would call the cult of the saints. The first one is this big discussion over the use of icons. What are icons? The cross is considered an icon. You have them on your desktop, right? What are they on your desktop? Symbols that represent something else. They're pictures. Okay, and you click on them and it opens up that thing it represents. Well, that's kind of the idea that they had with these icons that they looked at. There's a long history of using them, but there's a cult that kind of develops around that. Here's the problem, is that let's say that you want to remember Mary. So you make an image of Mary. Well, once you have an image, the common person looks at that and says, now Mary was the mother of God. So if Mary was the mother of God, That means she's probably pretty close with God right now. I like that. Because I'm not really sure how comfortable I am going to God with my problems. But Mary would understand. Because Mary's all human. And if I approached Mary, well, she lives there right now. And so she could put in a good word for me. So you pray to the saint, and the saint intercedes for you. Not the Spirit, not Christ, the saint. And this cult starts to develop. And part of that is from this whole idea of icons. And so the discussion comes, do they have power? When you're looking at an icon, does the icon have power? Well, it's decided that they're direct representations. So when you see an image of John the Baptist and you pray to it, you're not actually supposed to be praying to that image. You're supposed to be praying through that image to God. And then that image representing the person takes that to God on your behalf and gets a better answer than you could because you don't really live there.
It worked out because sometimes you pray for something good to happen.
And it would happen.
It would happen, and, well, that then sort of blesses the whole concept.
Right. But the problem is, only the clergy really understood that. Because only the clergy was really educated, for the most part. And the common person did exactly what you said, and that is, they would go up and they would pray to this thing, and great stuff would happen, and that was it. From now on, forget praying to God or to Jesus. I am going to pray to John the Baptist because that works. Or I'm going to pray to James. Or I'm going to pray to Lou Gerdes, or whoever else that you have as a saint, Saint Barbara, and get those results that I'm looking for. And if that person had something in their life that is associated with what I'm going through right now, all the better. Because they have feelings for what I'm going through. And so I will approach them. One of the problems is the controversy that comes up with. See, ideally, the icon is supposed to point you at God. And in the West, that was much better understood. In the East, because of the way their mysticism worked in their culture, when they saw an icon of a person, it was a captured image of the person. It represented the essence of that person. So when you prayed to an image of John, you were really praying to John because that image was his essence. That raised problems in the West. Why would we do this?
It
would be like worshiping images. And the controversy comes about like 725 to 800s, 843. There's this big controversy that's really ongoing and goes through many generations of emperors, many discussions, many church leaders, and it's a battle that seesaws back and forth. The Emperor Leo III is finally the one who instituted a reform and said, I'm getting rid of icons in the East altogether. You have icons, I kill you. Well, that got rid of them pretty quick in most areas. What also happened is that his kingdom began to fragment because other people said, no, this is the way you worship. We're not going to do it. And you're too far away to really do anything about it because you have political pressures from all the world around you because by now Islam is advancing rapidly over the face of the earth. And you've got the little Byzantium Empire, which used to be the huge Byzantium Empire, surrounded on three sides by Muslims. And Muslims have a unique thing in their culture about images. You can't have any. In fact, you can't make a representation of any sort of anything that has been created. So all of their architecture, all of their paintings, all of their mosaic work is just geometric design. Because you don't dare create an image of something that was made. The only thing that would be worse than that was to create an image of the maker. The church in Byzantium, their kingdom was rapidly falling into the hands of Muslims and eventually would fall entirely into the hand of Muslims. They had to make some accommodations for that. So you're not living in hostility with your neighbors. And for a long time, they live in peace with the Muslims, even after Byzantium was conquered. and became Muslim, the church still continued to exist, albeit without any communication with the West. But eventually they did away with a lot of the icons. They still maintained some. There was no reason for them not to that they could come up with. But they had to come up with something that would allow them to stay in the good graces of the Western church and not divide, so there couldn't be two churches. And the argument comes down to two groups. You have a group called the iconoclasts, and we're up here. I'm not following this exactly, but we're looking at icons. So we're looking at the last thing on the list. The iconoclasts were the people who were saying, you cannot have an image of God. The Old Testament absolutely forbids it. We forbid it. You cannot have an image of God. And then there was the iconodules. And the iconodules had a little bit different view of it. What they thought is, well, technically what the Old Testament is saying is not to make a graven image. It doesn't really mean drawings. It's more like statues and idols. So you can't do that. And so in the East, you ended up with a group of people that said, well, you can have images. And so they painted pictures of all of their saints everywhere. No statues. And in the West said, it doesn't really matter because they're all things that point you at God. So you have this abundance of statues and pictures. Actually, more statues than pictures often. Because it gave you something that was physical that you could touch that would bring you in close proximity to God and your faith. And they thought it was really important that people had something they could put their hands on to remind them constantly of their faith. The two didn't agree on it. The two would never agree on it. So how do you come up with resolution? Well, the way it worked was whoever was emperor at the time decided. And it worked that way for a long time, and that was happy for everybody. It still came down to the fact that the image represented the real person in the East because of the way their mysticism works. And in the West, it did not. And in the eyes of the clergy in the West, the fact that they had statues and images was simply a good way for the average person to contact God. It gave them a real life thing that they could look at that brought them close to God. I think honestly the clergy was somewhat fooled into thinking that the common person would never then end up worshiping the idol itself. But that's what happened. And so I'm gonna divert just a little bit and talk about the cult of the saints, and we'll get back on the rest of this in a moment here. In the cult of the saints, what we have is this concept of people beginning to worship the image of the saints themselves, and then the saints themselves, because they bestowed specific power upon people. And those powers often had something to do with their death or their resistance to change or to stand up for a cause that was godly. And so that commuted power to you when you prayed to them, because the power that they had in life was nothing compared to the power that they now have in death, standing in the very presence of God. And both churches, both the Eastern and Western church, fell into what we would call the cult of the saints, where they both spent a great deal of time praying to people or through people that were not God. And it took a long time to get that under even some semblance of control. It still occurs today very much. If you see the preponderance of Mary statues that people pray before, the idea is you pray before them, not to them. You pray in front of the statue, through the statue, into God. But it's not how the average person really sees it all the time. It becomes a distinction that the clergy can say, this is what we're really doing, that the layman says, it's not how I saw it. Because anytime I talk to Mary, things happen. The distinction that they made are, there is veneration. Veneration is what you do with a saint. It's dulia, Latin dulia. It is recognition of exceptional character or ability. The way the Catholic Church would describe it is you give people the gold medal when they win in the Olympics. That's veneration. On the other hand, latria is adoration. And that is what you do for God, that only God gets. It is reserved for Him, complete adoration. The problem is that when early authors discussed it, they didn't see a difference between the two, and so they used the same word, veneration or adoration. This became a distinction that was added later to keep from separating. But initially, it could be done. You could simply venerate the saint and receive heavenly blessing. A couple of saints that I wanted to talk about. Most people have heard of Polycarp. And the story of Polycarp, and I'm seeing a lot of heads nod, how Polycarp was martyred. He was burned at the stake. The story goes is that he was brought before the proconsul in the crowd, and the guy who was the proconsul said, okay, here's the deal, Polycarp. You're 83 years old. Everybody respects you. I really don't want to see you die, but the Jews are really anxious to have you die. And they've made this huge pile of wood because it was the Feast of Booths, and so they went up on their rooftops and tore down all their little wooden buildings and made a giant pyre in the middle of the stadium to burn Polycarp on. It looked more like it was for elephants, but it was for Polycarp, an 83-year-old man. And he said, if you will tell the crowd that you are mistaken about Jesus, then I'll set you free. Even now. And he said, okay, I'll do that. So he turned around and he faced the crowd, and in the best voice that he could get at 83, he said, people of Smyrna, you are mistaken about Jesus the Christ. And the proconsul said, no, that's not what I meant. And having no other choice, they bound him, led him up to the top of the pyre, lit the pyre on fire. Then legend comes in. Legend says that he asked to not be tied up because of his age. And he simply stood and took the fire and never cried out. Legend says that one of the men standing next to him was so overcome by his faith that he stuck a spear in his side, and the blood that flowed out of his side turned into doves and winged their way to heaven. So that's what happens with legend, and when you begin to venerate saints, is that these stories grow up around them, and the stories themselves become as important as what really happened. The fact that there was a godly man in Smyrna who was an elder in the church there that said, I will not deny Christ, and died for it. That really did happen. Everything else gets made up to provide you prayer opportunity so that there are things that Polycarp went through that you can go through. And you can actually see God working through him. The fact that he died on a fire wasn't inspiring to a lot of people. The fact that God showed a visible sign of his faith through turning his blood into doves was. And that's the kind of thing that we see. Another example, how many people have heard of Wilgefortis? Great saint, Wilgefortis. This was another one that occurred around the 5th century. Wilgefortis, as legend goes, was a young lady who was a virgin. Her father was a king in a small, weak kingdom. And her dream was to marry a godly man. Her father's dream was to secure his borders. The best way to do that was to marry his beautiful young daughter Wilgefortis off to the pagan king who lived next door that was much more powerful and was abusive. So he promised Wilgefortis to this king. Wilgefortis said, I'd rather not. And her father said, you have no say. So she took a vow before the Lord of virginity, that she would remain a virgin all her life. Well, the rules in the Old Testament say that a father can override either his wife's or his daughter's vow. So she didn't tell her father. Instead, she prayed to God and said, here's the deal, Lord. I have taken a vow before you to stay a virgin because I wish to have godly children, not the children of a pagan man. Will you protect me from him, please? And God protected her by allowing her to sprout a luxurious, rich beard, which promptly ended her engagement with the pagan king, and she was saved. Until her father came to understand what had happened and questioned her on it, and she said, yes, I took a vow of virginity, and I prayed to God, and he protected me. So her father crucified her. And in the process of crucifying her, one of her silver slippers fell off and landed in the hands of a poor man. So, where did the story come from? In the East, the Eastern Orthodox Church was really getting into the whole idea of images. And in fact, they had even begun to produce statues. One of the artisans there created a 12-foot-tall statue of Christ on the cross and put him in the garb of a priest of the Eastern Orthodox Church, which promptly arrived in Germany as it was. And the Germanic peoples looked at it and said, "Holy cow, our brothers in the East have created an image of Christ in a dress. What are we going to do?" Because it was just, it could not be done. It was sacrilegious. There was no way that they could accept Christ in a dress. So you make a story, a good story, to explain it away, because the concept of culture for many of these people was their neighbors a mile down the road was all they knew. So they had no concept that in another nation, 1,500, 2,000 miles away, somebody actually might be wearing a tunic for their religious rites. It never occurred to them. So they made up this story about Wilberforce. Although Wilberforce was widely prayed to worldwide, she became exceedingly popular with wives who were in abusive marriages, because she would protect them. And she became the saint that protected you if you divorced your husband because he was abusive. And the church didn't like that. So the church began to look into the whole Wilberforce thing and found out that that's actually how it had been developed. And they finally, once and for all, issued a bull from the papacy that said, "You cannot worship Wilberforce because Wilberforce wasn't a real person. It is a cult. It is a heresy. Stop." Any idea when that was, Tom?
No.
1969. So, that was Wilberforce. That's right. They rushed right in on top of it. Probably the biggest one that the church has struggled with is Mary. Both Eastern Orthodox and the Catholic Church have struggled with the cult of Mary, worshiping Mary. And where this comes from, this is a real problem, because remember, a lot of these things that they had to work out early, they're coming from that Greek background, and they're trying to take Greek philosophy and mix it with their Christianity. What is the nature of man? What is the nature of deity? And then they have to define Christ on those terms instead of the terms that the Bible does. Well, you end up having this big issue, because now Christ is born to a woman. Well, that's a problem. Even though the Bible clearly says that he was born of immaculate conception, that the Holy Spirit simply covered Mary and she was with child, that he placed Jesus inside of her, and she remained a virgin. They're fine with that. The problem was, what do you do with Mary? Because God cannot reside in the imperfect, based on the rules that they've already established about what the nature of Christ is. He cannot reside in the imperfect. So Mary has to be perfect. How do you make Mary perfect? Now, initially, there was this concept of immaculate conception for Mary that meant God created her in the womb of her mother, and her mother was a virgin. But that wouldn't hold up with other doctrines. The established doctrine, that is now doctrine of the Catholic Church, says, when Mary was conceived in the womb, the Holy Spirit came on her in the womb at the time of conception and removed from her original sin. So she was not in need of salvation. Yeah. Yeah, the chapter and verse eludes me right now. However, that is what they decided. So that when she was born, she had no sin, because they believe that when you are born, you have all of the sin of mankind with you. That's what we talked about with original sin. It's the original breaking that comes with you. Now, Mary couldn't have that and bear Jesus. So she was freed from it while she was still in the womb of her mother. Then she was born, never sinned. She had no desire to sin because she did not have original sin. So she lived an absolutely perfect life, just as her son did. And as a virgin, became impregnated by the Holy Spirit. And remained a virgin her entire life. There's some speculation about where the brothers came from. Usually it says Joseph was old enough that he had married somebody else who died in childbirth, and then he married Mary. That's where the brothers came from, which would make all of his brothers older than him. That's where it comes from. Yeah, unfortunately there's not a chapter and verse for that one either. However, I do have part of a papal bull that I can read to you to show you that it's law. The problem is that then, because she is perfect the rest of her life, remember that during this time, 500 to 900, just the simple act of intercourse is considered a sinful act. Remember, clergy is now being banned from marrying. The Eastern Orthodox Church does not do that. And we see that as one of the differences, is that the Eastern Orthodox Church says, why could clergy not marry? They did in the New Testament. They said, no, you're mistaken. The Catholic Church said, you're mistaken. They did not marry in the New Testament. And that was one of their dividing points. But in the case of Mary, it became very important that she never had lain with any man, because the act of sexual intercourse was considered a sinful thing for the brokenness of mankind to begin with. So she could not have ever done that. Now comes her assumption. The act of her being taken to heaven. It was believed for a long time and taught for a long time that after Jesus ran his ministry, that Mary was simply taken to heaven, whole. But that flew in the face of some other doctrines that they have regarding the flesh, the nature of the flesh of mankind. And they couldn't maintain it. So eventually the Catholic Church changed that doctrine to be another completely different doctrine, and that was the doctrine that she died and was immediately assumed in heaven. So she did have assumption. Now, not everybody agreed with that. Some people disagreed with it. This is something, the belief in the corporeal assumption of Mary was formally declared to be dogma by Pope Pius XII in 1950. Pope Pius XII states in Manifentissimus Deus, I think, that's really close to the pronunciation, we pronounce, declare, and define it to be a definitive revealed dogma that the Immaculate Mother of God, the ever-Virgin Mary, having completed the course of her earthly life, was assumed body and soul into heavenly glory. Hence, if anyone, which God forbid, should dare willfully to deny or to call into doubt that which we have just defined, let him know that he has fallen away completely from the divine and Catholic faith. You will go to hell if you say that Mary did not go body and soul to heaven. That way there's not as much doubt about it. And that's showing the power of what a papal bull does. And that's part of this whole cult of the saints. The other thing that came up was the cult of relics. It's really closely tied to the cult of saints, and that is collecting things that were last in possession of the saint. In fact, the reliquiae, the Latin term is things that have been left behind. They were left behind on purpose so that you could have them. And something that Calvin took exception with was, you can't worship these things. They're not real anyway. How is it possible that there are six heads from John the Baptist in Europe? That was a question, yeah, because it's to this day, actually at Calvin's time, I think they were closer to 20. But today, there are still six institutions that venerate and have in their possession the head of John the Baptist. Six of them today. So you can see why people say you can't do this. Now, body parts were much more valuable than instruments of use. Unless those instruments revolved around Mary or the cross. Anything that had to do with Jesus or Mary was powerful, powerful, because you couldn't get parts from Jesus or Mary. They were both taken away physically. So there were no body parts. But you could get things that they touched. What's that? like the spear of destiny idea, yeah. Well, to give you an idea, Constantine's mother, I think her name was Helen, was credited with taking a trip to the Holy Land and finding the cross on Golgotha. And so it was distributed, pieces of it, so that everybody could have a piece of the cross. And scholars from that time who were debunking the idea of the importance of all of these relics will tell you there were enough pieces of the true cross floating around just in Europe to build a forest. I mean, mountains of the true cross just in Europe. Because everybody had a piece. All you had to have was a piece of wood, and it's the true cross. Bones of all the apostles. It's not possible that Peter had 37 arms. But that was the kind of thing that happened, is people gathered these and then they would pray through them. And the concept was that it still went with this mysticism and their idea of the resurrection. Their concept of the resurrection that led into this was still part of these early controversies. And what they said was, when you die, we'll pick on Roger for a minute. When Roger dies, his body is laid in the grave. And all of the structure of his body, all of the pieces, no matter what happens to them, in the last day, every molecule of his existence will be reassembled in heaven into a perfect body. It doesn't account for the fact that somebody may have died in a field that was later turned into an orchard and you ate some of the fruit and you share some of those molecules. I don't know how they deal with that. But that wasn't the concept at the time. The concept was that when people died, they went into tombs. And so you can see the great value of praying before a tomb. Now I'll read you, I think if I want to read all or part of this, I'll read it. It's information about how people would look at the importance of these relics. To understand the religious practices which coalesce specifically around relics in medieval Christianity, it's important to understand it from their perspective. A saint was above all else someone whose soul currently resided in that court in heaven. On the day of the last judgment, every human being's body was to be reassembled from the pieces which had once constituted it. Thus, the corporal relics of the saint were not only objects in what, that had once been part of the saint, but they continued to be an essential part of the saint's person and would be part of the saint's glorified body following the last judgment. So when you look at it from this perspective, a tomb or a reliquary did not simply contain dead bones. When you prayed before this relic, you were actually praying before the real living person whose spirit is residing in heaven. And those dead bones are going to reanimate on the last day in the throne room of God. As a 5th century inscription at the tomb of Martin of Tours read, "Here lies Bishop Martin of holy memory, whose soul is in the hand of God, but who is completely present here, manifesting through the power of miracles his every grace." So relics then became something that became the power of God, and they were the relics of the saints. It's an unfortunate practice. It's a practice that the Catholic Church has stepped away from some, but still continues to this day. When I was a boy in the 70s, Pope John Paul had to go to South America to deal with an uprising of the cult of Mary. It still occurs, and it's replacing Christ with people who were holy. And that's the dangerous part.
The idea of pilgrimages was much more prevalent in the Middle Ages than it is today.
Right.
And so it was important to have relics at your church so people would come visit not just the church but the town and bring all their...
Right, and pilgrimages began as a very Eastern idea, but are they biblical?
Well, no, but we talk about this a little bit in our Sunday morning classes. Suppose we had what we knew to be the original Luke or Matthew,
right,
or pick one or pick several. Imagine what would happen if that were extant. Where would you keep it? Who would own it? Who would get the benefit of it? And people would tend to look at that thing as having some kind of power in and of itself.
Right. And they had chapter and verse that they would quote on this, things that were recognized for everybody. For instance, the idea of Elisha dying and being buried in a cistern or a cave.
Right.
And then later on, raiders come into the land, and one of the men of Israel is killed. So they toss him in the cave so that they can finish the battle. And he comes in contact with the bones of Elisha and springs back to life, healthy. And they use that to point and say, that's exactly what we're saying happens. And it was something that most church members did not want to refute because it was such a wide practice by that time. It wasn't actually until the Reformation came along that most Reformation leaders said, this is not right. You're no longer worshiping Christ. You're no longer worshiping the God of heaven. You're worshiping the people that he made. And they stopped it in their practices almost altogether. Although there's still some of it that occurs in certain forms of Protestantism, Lutheranism, especially with Mary. And it's still clung to pretty tight. Other things that separated the two churches, because now you have churches that have occurred on different continents a long ways apart from each other, and then are separated by war and eventually by culture, the celebrating of Easter. That's one of the things that most people point to today. It really wasn't the biggest thing at the time, but it's one of the things that we see today as the biggest thing and the easiest thing to point at is when they celebrate Easter. And the problem is that the way the Jewish calendar works is a little bit different than the way the Julian calendar works, is a little bit different than the way the Georgian calendar works. And the Julian calendar, the Roman calendar, was the one that Rome had used forever. So it's the one that Byzantium used. But with the influx of the Goths, Visigoths, Ostrogoths in Rome, they adopted the Georgian calendar, which is more accurate. So then they could pinpoint the day that Easter actually was, when Passover really was, based on the paschal moon. This is when it really happened. Big arguments occur when you're using a different calendar. In all actuality, the exact day of Easter for both churches falls on the same day fairly regularly. Or it can be off by 1, 4, or 5 days, depending on the year. But on a fairly regular basis, it's on the same day. It seems ludicrous to us today, based on our view of holidays, that that would be something that you would split church over. But they did. Other things, we talked about marriage already. They had a different language. Language is a huge thing because language, we've already talked about, language affects the way you think. The fact that the people in Byzantium were Eastern and spoke an Eastern language, eventually a Slavic language, but they spoke different languages, made them think different. In the West, we write from left to right. In the East, they don't. So we think of, it changes the way we think what is right and wrong. Right is right. You're right. Left is wrong. You don't want children that are left-handed. Didn't matter there, it does here. So children were forced to learn to use their right hand because one was right and one was wrong. And that's a product of language. That's one of the things that we look at up here. The other one, we talked about the celebration of Easter on the 14th day of Nisan, clerical marriage, theology, the papacy. We talked just a minute about the papacy, the fact that in Rome they had one leader that was the leader of the church, the Pope. And in Eastern Orthodoxy, they had leaders of the churches that worked in committee, like mini popes, very powerful men, but not over the whole church. Eventually, the discussion and the argument would become so severe that the church in Rome simply excommunicated the Church of the East. But that's easy to fix. You see, all the church in the East had to do was excommunicate the church in the West. All fixed. And we'll just go out through history not having to have unity or like each other because they're not going to heaven. They've been excommunicated. And that's a product of this being unable to come to terms with what is part of my culture And what have I adopted that is not the Word of God? And where are we now? And how are we going to be united as a church? They eventually said, maybe it's best not to be united.
When did those excommunications occur?
Those were much later. I believe they were around 1100. So the battle started around 500-600. See, the church in Rome for a long time was almost a church in exile. Rome was ruled by the Goths, and although church was there, it didn't wield the power that Byzantium did. Eventually, that power came back.
I was trying to think of when the Crusades started. I thought there was one before 1100. They were mostly after 1100.
Yeah, for the most part. And interestingly, a response. A lot of times, our culture looks at things and says, we're at fault, we're at fault, we're at fault. In the case of the Crusades, and that's one of the things we were going to talk about, we decided to do the saints instead. One of the things that occurs that we don't actively acknowledge is that most of Southern Europe was conquered by the Moors. Much of Italy was sacked by, or Rome was sacked by them. They conquered all of Spain, lost it completely, North Africa. Everything that Justinian had retaken for the East to become part of the Byzantine Empire again was lost to the Moors, and then some. In response to that, when Europe finally became strong, they threw them out. And then went back and began taking the Middle East from them. And there's a lot of political reasons for that that are not spiritual in any way, that were deemed spiritual at the time. But the fact of the matter is, war was going both ways. and much of Europe had already been conquered by the Moors before Europe retaliated.
Well, I was trying to recall if the East and West joined in Crusades, or were they...
They did on a couple of rare occasions. They joined, especially at first. Later, they decided to go their own ways. And eventually, the East became absorbed into an Islamic empire. And once they were absorbed, they really had no power to marshal an army. They did have huge rights. You see, when Islam first came in, there was a different way of viewing Islam. Most Christians, when Islam first started coming in, they looked at Islam as if it was just a Christian heresy, because they knew all the elements of Islam were taken out of the Christian Bible. It wasn't something that was revealed to him, or it was just something that he wrote down part from partial memory. And that was obvious, so it was a heresy. And they treated it like a heresy. But then when they began to get power, a lot of Christians said, see, the church has gotten soft, and this is God's judgment on you. He's sending these heretics in here, these Muslims, and they're taking over your cities. And that's God's judgment on you for not being strong in your faith. The other thing that some people saw was, everything has a yin and yang. Everything has a good and a bad. And that the Muslim empire is... The Muslims that are conquering the earth are basically a demonic counterset or a demonic expression of the false church. And so they were viewed a lot differently than we would view them today. Initially, when Christians saw the Muslims coming, they said, this is a cue for us to repent of what we've been doing, all of our infighting and bickering and godlessness. Then second, it was apocalyptic. This is the end of the world. Christianity is going to be wiped out by these guys. And then finally, we'll call it polemic. Especially in the East, they are our enemies, and they should be treated as enemies. And that's kind of where we leave off, other than we look at how did Islam treat Christianity. And when Islam came in and took over Constantinople, the Christians were allowed to continue worshiping. In fact, the bishop of the Church of Constantinople was made a leader in the government, and he was in charge of all the Christians. all of Eastern Orthodoxy was put under his control. He had vast power, both military and political, as long as he held the line. But in the meantime, rules still applied. Christians could not directly try to convert Muslims to Christianity, and Muslims were free to convert Christians. And if the need arose for a church to become a mosque, it did. So those were things where they lost. And the center of control for the Eastern Orthodox Church moved north, out of the reach of Islam, into Moscow. And so if you ask the Russian Orthodox Church, how does Moscow fit in? They will tell you, Moscow is the third Rome. Moscow is the replacement for Constantinople. And that's how the Eastern Orthodox Church or the Russian Orthodox Church would view it. That's a lot of information, and maybe a little bit more skipping around than Darren does, but I want if there's any questions I can ask, or answer, yeah, if there's any questions I can ask, it would be, why on earth did he ask me? Yeah. So, a couple of other things I'll mention. Just the Orthodox Church is, we see them very, very much involved in missions, especially in the Balkans. One preacher there alone claimed to have converted 75,000 Slavs by himself. Now, some of those conversions are as questionable as Constantine's conversions. But the fact of the matter is they were very effective in their teaching, because anything that was considered pagan was stomped on. And when what you're doing gets you and your family killed, and what the other guy is doing gets you and your family praised, it's pretty easy to move to the thing that gets you praised. And so Christianity did move both through violence and through missions during that time. Cyril was the guy. Cyril was the one who did all of the mission work, 75,000 people. Eventually, we get the Cyrillic alphabet. They developed a writing that allowed them to end up with Bibles of their own. And we talk about Bibles, first printing press and first Bibles coming out into the English language. The Germans actually had a very early Bible that was written by a Goth, translated into his language. And so we see some of those things occurring as pagan states adopt Christianity. But when Russia became Christian, and Vladimir of Russia in 988 accepted Orthodox Christianity, that was the big shift from Constantinople north. And that coincided with the influx of Islam. Okay, any other questions? Now that I've answered two of my own.
Well, I guess I'm wondering about denominations and who might be represented by each of these groups as far as denominations that I would be familiar with today.
That's another era. That's going to come much later as these begin to break off.
But some of this is, well, right, I mean, I realize a lot of them are denominated, but mm-hmm. as far as I think of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. So Catholicism was already in place, and that we would call that the Western Christianity, and then the Western Church out of Rome was Catholicism.
Pretty much the death.
Much of
each other, or was Catholicism part of the Western Church, or were they one and the same?
Catholicism was the Western Church for all intents and purposes for a long time. It's a product of having the government control the church. Remember, Constantine came in and gave great benefit to the church. Eventually, the church gained more power than the government. And that's going to occur much later in history. We start seeing guys like Charlemagne that begin the Holy Roman Empire. But first, Rome has to get back into the hands of Christians. And that process begins with Justinian, and he has some great successes, and he loses some of those successes. And eventually, maybe just from reaching too far, ultimately causes the collapse of the Byzantine Empire himself by trying to restore Rome's glory.
And then as far as the Eastern Church, I guess I think of Eastern Orthodox as kind of a conservative group.
Yeah. Well, and if you look at orthodoxy as simply right teaching. So to call themselves the Eastern Rite teachers, you know, I mean, that's, and that's right. That's how they view it. We teach the right thing and other people don't, but we are always going to teach the right thing. And, for a long time, as far as major groups, those were the only two major groups. There were other smaller groups that developed, but we don't see permanent groups until later.
That's kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah, when we get to the Reformation in the 1600s, then we really start to see branching. And often what we see when there is especially violent branching is people who don't like one thing that is occurring, and they respond to it by going to the total opposite spectrum, and frequently use Scripture as just justification to do that, but don't actually follow the letter of Scripture. They simply say, I want to move as far away from this thing as I can get. And you end up with people like Martin Luther that takes his Bible and every single place that the word faith occurs, writes next to it, alone. Faith alone. So people would say, yeah, praise Martin Luther for ever doing that, but in reality, Martin Luther changed what the Bible said to meet his will and his needs because he was so fed up with what the Catholic Church was doing. His response was to go too far the other way.
So I yes. often wondered, so when that Catholic Church grew, were there any pockets of non-Catholic Christians congregations?
In many places there were, yes. And we find that in Africa, all over Asia. And remember that even the apostles went much further than just the Middle East. In fact, legend says that Thomas was an evangelist in India. And there are churches that have been existent in India for a long time, very tiny, and have waned much over the years, but still existed. And in other parts of the world, including parts of Europe, and a lot of times individual villages. Ultimately, the real hard fact of it is the Bible wasn't accessible to people. The Bible was Latin, and only people who were greatly educated spoke Latin. Most of the priesthood did not even truly understand Latin. A lot of them were slightly undereducated, especially when we get to the end of Justinian's reign, where bubonic plague starts stepping in and having a major effect on not just the population of the world, but the culture of the world because of disease.
So